red, white, and blue. Love American style. That's me and you. And on a star-spangled night, my love,
you can rest
your head on my shoulder. Goodbye, rain. She's wearing my school ring on her chain. She's my steady, I'm her man. I'm gonna love her all I can.
And joining us right now on PMP Network is one of my favorite songwriters. You know, when you think back of some of the great theme songs from television, whether it was Love Boat or Happy Days or Laverne and Shirley or all these great songs, Wonder Woman. One of the ones I actually liked a lot was Maureen McGovern's version of a song called Different World, which was from a show called Angie. Many of you might not remember that one, but you might remember the song. And I remember when Maureen McGovern was in studio here with us, she mentioned how much she liked that song as well. And maybe you like Killing Me Softly with her song, or Ready to Take a Chance Again, or some of these other contemporary hits, all written by the same person, Charles Fox. He joins us right now. He's the author of a book called Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music. And when it comes to music, boy, you've conquered every world, from movies to TV to the pop charts.
Oh, thanks, Mark. Very nice to be with you, by the way. You know, I've had a very extensive career, reaching from one end of music business to the other, and I'd be hard-pressed to tell you what I like doing more, because I like doing them all so much. Most people wouldn't know that my earliest songs were in Spanish, even though I don't speak Spanish, but I was, when I was 15 years old, I worked in the Catskill Mountains in a band. And that summer I discovered Latin music, and I fell in love instantly with Latin music. And I started to listen to all the Latin records around. Well, eventually I got to play in some of those bands, and some of the great bands like Ray Barreto and Tito Puente, And I actually wrote songs for those bands and arrangements. And later on, when I was probably about 18 or 19 years old, I had to make the transition to into American songwriting, which was not on my horizon at the beginning.
So you could have just been known as a charanga player, but you expanded.
My first album was a charanga band. It was called Charles Fox and His Charanga.
Well, yeah. And there's actually a picture in the book of the album.
That's
Charles
right.
Fox. Yeah, it was called Just for Fun. I kind of like looking at some of the photos in here and things, as well as reading the information here. You were working with, I was looking at a picture of you with one of the first Moog synthesizers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that thing changed music, but now there's that new machine that makes everybody's voice sound the same. I can't stand that thing.
You know, there's been so many innovations in electronics. When I was 18 years old, I went to Paris, and a year out of high school, in high school, I got into a composition class. My teacher, Mark Lawner, was inspiring to me, and I started to compose. And I studied with him privately for a year after high school while I was playing with bands. And a year later, I had the great good fortune in my life to go to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger, who was Aaron Copland's teacher 40 years before me, and generations of composers. I went there just for the summer. My family had very little money. My father was a window cleaner, but they sent me for the summer, and it was a great thrill to be going to meet and work with Nadia Boulanger. Anyway, she asked me to stay on and study with her in Paris, and I ended up staying 2 years with her, and that was really a life-changing experience for me. Her influence still—I feel on every day of my life. She gave me a really, truly the gift of music.
And for those who read the book, you'll actually read letters that went back and forth from there, which tells a lot about what was going on with you at the time.
Exactly right. You know, those letters, by the way, were the stimulant for writing the book. We only found those letters as they were tucked away in a shoebox in my mother's dresser drawer a couple of years before she passed away in the Bronx, the same apartment I was raised in. She was living here with us in California at the time. But when we went to bring back the important things of memory for my mother, to bring it back to California, we found the shoebox, and in it were all these letters, about 200 letters. And I wrote, you know, now these days when people send emails and text messages, our letters are very brief. I wrote long, extensive letters about my work in Paris, about my studies in music, about the reflection of life in Paris in 1959, 1960. And anyway, among other things going on in the musical world in Paris at those days was of a lot of electronic music, which I must say I hated at that time. I didn't like it. But this was way before the synthesizer was invented. In 1964, when I was back home and married now, and trying to get started in the world of commercial music, I spent a year at Columbia University studying electronic music in their music. It was called the Princeton Columbia Electronic Music Laboratory. There's only one of five in the world. And I wouldn't begin to tell you how electronic music was made, but the teacher was one of the innovators, if not the man who created electronic music himself, a man named Uzicheski. Well, when the first synthesizer came out, I was online, and I bought one of the very first ones directly from Robert Moog. And the thing that was extraordinary about this instrument, with that big picture that you saw, is that for the first time you could play a piano keyboard and musical notes would come out. And that was the beginning of electronic music as we know it today.
I want to talk to you about so many things in the book. We've got a lot of things to talk about that I've marked up. One of them was one of my favorite moments in The Tonight Show. A lot of people remember the Eddie Ames performance where he threw the tomahawk and it landed in the crotch of a caricature that was drawn on a wall. And he performed Try to Remember, which was one of my favorite songs. Try to Remember. I mean, what a great voice he had. And the interesting thing was that you were the arranger on that song, and you were there.
I was there at that moment. I was Ed Ames' arranger that day for The Tonight Show, and he did a couple songs, one of which was Try to Remember. And after we finished rehearsing the band, he was on a show called Daniel Boone, and he played an Indian. But he had never thrown a tomahawk in his life. But someone handed him a tomahawk, and there was a cutout, as we in television land have seen, of this cowboy on a board, on a wooden board. And someone just handed him a tomahawk and said, throw it at the figure. he threw it about 10 times, and 10 times in a row it bounced off the wall. It never stuck in. So finally a stagehand came up to him and said, and just turned the tomahawk around. His normal way with throw it was the point aiming at the wooden board. He turned around so the point was towards him, the point of the tomahawk. And by throwing that backwards now, in a sense, it just stuck in. They marked the spot with tape where he was standing. And that was the end of it. And after he sang his show, he sang his song, Johnny Carson came over, handed him the tomahawk, and he threw it once and stuck in, and, you know, the rest is television history. The funny thing about that was I was right there. Ed was so embarrassed where it stuck in. He circumcised this cowboy, you know, on the spot, and he was anxious to pull it out of the board. And Johnny Carson, who was, I guess, a comedic genius, he knew how to milk the moment, and he wouldn't let him. And Ed kept lunging for the board, and Johnny kept pulling him back. And it was just a funny moment.
Mm. Now, in terms of television, you did some movies, and then you did TV. What were the big breaks in terms of movies and television?
Well, I've done altogether about 100 movies for theatricals and for television films. The second film I did was a picture called Barbarella. It was a picture of Jane Fonda, and Raja Vadim, her husband, was the director. When we were working on that film, I was brought into it by my friend Bob Crew, who was great songwriter who produced and wrote all the Four Seasons hits, and is a persona on the stage in Jersey Boys, because he's the one who discovered the Four Seasons, mm-hmm. and he co-wrote those songs. Bob brought me in to work with him and Barbarella. We wrote him about 5 or 6 songs, and here it was this young fellow in New York, but Bob wasn't the film scorer, and I had just done my first picture called The Incident. So Paramount came out to see what was going on. We recorded this in New York. De Laurentiis came out, who just passed away, unfortunately. And the head of music for Paramount Pictures came out. And it was a chance for me to be seen by the people from Hollywood in New York, because that's where we did the film. So Larry Pierce's next film, he was the director of The Incident, my first film, was Goodbye Columbus. And that was going to be shot and recorded in California. I was up for that film, but as a result of having done Barbarella and the people from Paramount seeing me, I was then invited to come to California to do Goodbye Columbus, which turned out to be a very big, successful picture. Started the career of Alan McGraw and Dick Benjamin. And for me, it was a really great entree to Hollywood. While I was there, as soon as I finished the picture, the same head of music at Paramount said to me, "We have a pilot for a new series that we think is going to be a big hit. It's called Love America Style, and we'd like you to do it." So really, that kind of bridged the gap from New York to Hollywood. That one film called Barbarella, it brought me in, California brought me into movies, television, and television series. And you know, as I say, one thing leads to another.
And you also did some of the Goods and Todman game shows as well.
I did. I did a number of the Goods and Todman game shows, What's My Line, To Tell the Truth, Match Game, all things that were early on in my career, still living in New York, and those are all interesting experiences. Of course, when I would write those theme songs, Goodson Todman had an office in a beautiful building in New York, and Mark Goodson would always invite his whole staff in to listen to my little themes, and he had a big office with a big desk. And he'd invite all of his staff in to listen to this theme. And I would sit at the other end of the room. He had, I think it was like a three-quarter-sized piano, maybe a 66-note piano. He could have had, of course, a whole piano. And I would try to make this little theme work at the piano while, of course, I heard the whole orchestra playing in my mind. And Marco used to go around the room asking people what they thought about my theme, and no one ever said anything because they didn't know what he thought. And it wasn't until finally when I played again, I'd see his foot tapping, that I knew I had him. When his foot would tap, I knew he liked the music. Anyway, around the same time, I did my very first big television theme, which was for Wide World of Sports. It was 1965. And that led to the first television show on Monday Night for Football, Monday Night Football, which I did that theme also. It was 1967.
Huh. It's amazing the track record that you have. Are you still actively composing? I know you wrote this book, which is a great one. Again, it's called Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music. And it's available right now in stores near you or on Amazon or any of the other great sites. Are you writing as much now?
Oh, I am. By the way, I do have a website for the book. I'll just take a second to mention. It's killingmesoftly.com. And if your listeners are interested, there's the Roberta Flack foreword that she wrote. Beautiful foreword is there, pictures and some excerpts from the book, and also link to Amazon.com if anyone is interested. KillingMeSoftly.com.
Yeah, we'll put that up with the interview on the web.
Oh, terrific! So, well, I'm very much active. Yeah, this past August, I was just in Poland. Of course, my life in music has been very spread out, and from beginning with writing, you know, songs in Spanish that I mentioned, and all kinds of movie scores and television and ballets. Lately, I've been more involved in classical music. This past summer, I was in Gdańsk, Poland. The Polish government commissioned me to write a piece honoring the 200th birthday of Chopin. And I conducted an orchestra with the great American jazz clarinetist, Eddie Daniels, playing clarinet. I wrote it for him and one of the great Polish pianists, Leszek Mozdur. And we had 22,000 people in the area where the Solidarity movement started. It's the 30th anniversary of Solidarity, but my personal participation was to honor the 200th birthday of Chopin. And on the day that I came back from Gdańsk in August, the very next day was September 2nd, or in Beverly Hills terms, 90210, September 2nd, 10th. And the mayor of Beverly Hills had asked Hal David and I to write the official Beverly Hills theme song, so we premiered that song at a big occasion. 90210. It's called 90210 Beverly Hills, and we had Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis premiering. We just made a record, so I'm still very much involved and about to get working on a Broadway musical with Hal David that we've been working and getting the rights for some time. We're about to begin work.
I'm glad to hear that you're still writing, because we love your music. You know, one of the things that I did when I was in college, I was running a radio station in the early 70s. And one of the people that came by our desk was a Capitol Records artist, beautiful blonde from, I think she was from New York. Her name was Lori Lieberman. And I notice in your book, the section you have about Norm Gimbel and yourself and Lori Lieberman, and really the beginnings of Killing Me Softly, recorded by her.
Exactly right. Norman Gimbel and I discovered Lori Lieberman and decided that we would devote a lot of our time to writing songs for her. We got her the deal at Capitol Records, and we actually did four albums that we wrote and produced for Lori. And the very first album, the last song we wrote, was Killing Me Softly. And Lori was a wonderful artist. She, by the way, was from California, but she grew up in Switzerland, actually. She was a California girl, and she was about 18 years old when we first met her. And we worked for about 4 or 5 months just developing this musical style with her, you know. It's a beautiful voice and still has a gorgeous voice. Well, Capitol, among other things that Capitol did for us, was to get us programmed on American Airlines on their Theater in the Sky program. You know, these days, if you want to listen to music or watch films on airplanes, you bring that with you, you know, MP3s and DVDs and all those things, iPads, iPods.
Right.
In 1972 or 73, whenever this was, if you wanted to listen to music in the air, you were pretty well listening to pre-programmed material that the airline had. So fortunately for us, one day, Roberta Flack was flying she just had finished a concert with Quincy Jones in California, was heading back to New York. And she was flying on American Airlines, and she really was a prisoner of our music at 35,000 feet. And she told me that she took out a pencil and paper and started jotting down the lyric and the lyrics and the music at the same time. And when she got to New York, she called Quincy Jones, and she said, "How do I meet Charles Fox?" And Quincy gave her my number. And one day I was walking through the music library at Paramount Pictures, and someone handed me a telephone and said, "Here, this is for you." At the other end of the line, the voice said, and I can still hear it in my ear to this day, "Hi, this is Roberta Flack, and we haven't met, but I'm going to sing your songs." That was pretty outstanding for me because, number one, I hadn't had a hit song before that. And secondly, she had just won the Grammy Award for first time ever, so It's pretty extraordinary in my memory book, and those are sounds I'm happy to retain in my ear.
Yeah, that one and maybe the one from Stanley Jaffe inviting you to score Goodbye Columbus.
Exactly, yeah. That when I had that phone call, I had just come back from France. One of the not too unpleasant jobs I had after we did Barbarella was to fly to France to teach Jane Fonda how to sing the song that Bob Crew and I wrote, so that she could hum along with it while she was taking off her clothes on the main title for a long intergalactic voyage. It was Barbarella. And I came back from spending a few days in France with Jane and her husband, Roger Vadim, who was the director. And I was on the city streets in New York and just called home and from a public telephone booth. And my wife said, quickly, call Stanley Jaffe. He was a producer of Goodbye Columbus. And I had been up for the picture, but it wasn't until everything congealed with Barbarella that I was actually asked to do it. So that's another phone call I still hear in my ear with Stanley. Said, how'd you like to come to California to score Goodbye Columbus? It's amazing the things that we retain that have value to us, you know.
I think one of the cool ironies in the whole thing is that when you were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, Roberta Flack was the one who made the presentation.
She was, yeah. It was very, very significant to me. And after she rehearsed the song in the afternoon, we were sitting in the ballroom together. It was kind of empty at that point. And I was in the afternoon, and I was just chatting, and I said to Roberta, how fortunate for us that, you know, you found the song. And Roberta's a very spiritual and very beautiful person, a great artist. And she said, no, the song found me. And then and that night, she presented me with the induction to the Songwriter Hall of Fame. So it was a very significant part of my life.
Yeah, very cool. And, of course, you the song won the Best Song of the Year in 1973 Grammy Award.
It did. We won the Grammy for that, yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I didn't realize that that the song that you wrote for The Last Married Couple in America, that Maureen McGovern sang that one, too.
You know, that's a song that Norma Gimbel and I always felt, somehow we missed the boat on it because we always felt it was a hit record, and it wasn't. It didn't turn out not to be, but Maureen was fantastic on that.
And then of course, she recorded Different Worlds, which I mentioned earlier as we came in the interview,
right.
Because I love that. That was Series Angie, was a very interesting series. Didn't run that long, but well, that music was a great song, and it actually became a pop hit.
It did. Believe it or not, Angie ran about 6 years.
It did, really? I didn't realize it was that long.
Ran about 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was a pop hit with Maureen McGovern, so we could have it all for the picture Last Married Couple in America.
Mm.
That followed it, and we really thought we'd have a follow-up hit with Maureen McGovern. Her record was great. You never know about the music business, whether sometimes there's things sort of align and you get lucky, and other times all the work you put into things don't happen. But in either case, we made a record we're really proud of, and I love Maureen McGovern. She's really one of the great all-time singers, you know.
Oh, yeah. She's very talented. In fact, she came in our studio and visited, and she brought two dogs with her.
Oh, did she? Yeah, she's a good friend, and she's a lovely person.
Yeah. Now, you actually did a score for Steven Spielberg, too, right?
No, I didn't. Actually, I never worked with Steven Spielberg, but...
You did Sugarland Express.
I almost worked with him. When he was shooting his first picture called Sugarland Express, before the world knew of Steven Spielberg, he had made one television movie called Duel, which was a great picture.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me one day, and he said he was listening to his, on his way to film every day. He was listening on the radio, and he'd hear Killing Me Softly, and he said it became his favorite song. And he knew of my work in film, and he asked me if he could get together with me, then if I would score his picture, Sugarland Express. And I said, sure, it sounds great. He said, can I come over to your house and talk to you about it? So he came over to my house. We had lunch. And I became friendly with Steven, and I was planning to do that picture. I'd met with him a few times. Thought he was a terrific young director who really knew a lot about the art of filmmaking and the craft of filmmaking. I was in his office one day when John Schlesinger, the great director of Sunday, Bloody Sunday, called young Steven Spielberg, who was making his first picture for Universal. He got a call from Schlesinger, who was asking him all kinds of technical questions that Spielberg was giving him the answer. I didn't hear the questions, I only heard the answers. But they're very technical about using gels and camera lenses and things on different actors. Schlesinger was talking about coming to America to film a picture, and he called this young Steven Spielberg in the end. I came home and I said to my wife, boy, is he knowledgeable. He really knows his stuff about film. Eventually he called me to apologize and say that this is his first film, and Zanuck and Brown were the producers of the film, and they insisted that he use John Williams. And, of course, I understood, and those things happen sometimes, and I was busy with other work anyway. Of course, then he went on to become Steven Spielberg with capital letters. You know?
And John Williams became his big partner for a lot of the films that he did.
And you know what? I can only tell you that John Williams and Steven Spielberg together have forged a fantastic world of music and film together. And I think we're all better off for it. I mean, I think John Williams created this whole niche for film scoring that has brought up the whole level of film scoring, you know, and people's attitude towards what film music is. I mean, you know, you never used to see film music being performed in the concert hall. Now it's performed all the time. And I think John had a lot to do with that. Jerry Goldsmith had a lot to do with that, you know, Ella Bernstein. So in spite of the fact that I didn't get to do that movie or any movie with Steven, I always appreciated that, that brief friendship we had and all that he's done for the world of film.
Tell us a little bit about Operator and the John Denver, Jim Croce connection.
There was a picture called The Last American Hero. It was directed by Lamont Johnson, who sadly just passed away a few days ago. It was Jeff Bridges' first movie. And Norman Gimbel and I wrote a song that was going to be used as the main title, and it actually carved through the whole film, and I was going to score with that theme as well. There was an original singer who had a pretty good name, who was going to sing it and record it, and called me the last minute that he wasn't able to do it after holding on to the song for way too long. And now we're behind the eight ball because the picture's about to come out. 20th Century Fox was pushing me to get a record out, at least a singer to do it, so that we could get a record out. Otherwise, we'd just have to do it without a named singer, which would have no commercial value. So there were two singers that we thought. One was John Denver, and this other fellow coming up on the charts with a new song called Operator. His name was Jim Croce. Very different singers. John Denver had this free, wonderful, kind of spirited voice, a higher pitched voice, but we thought he'd be good, and he was a much bigger name than Jim Croce at the time. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we decided that Jim Croce matched the song more and matched the character of the person on the film more. Well, anyway, we played both songs, the song for both of them, over the phone because we had very little time. And you don't usually do that. You don't usually offer to two singers of the same. As a matter of fact, you never do that. But because we were behind the eight ball, we did. And both of them said, after hearing it over the phone, that they would sing it. And we just decided that Jim Croce would be the better voice to do that. And so I got his key, really. I never met Jim Croce before that. I got his key by listening to his record, and I made a track, full orchestra, in the 20th Century Fox soundstage. And brought it with me to New York. And when I met Jim for the first time in his producer's office, first thing he said is, after he said hello, can I hear that song again, man? And I sat at the piano and I played it and sang it for him. And he thought for a second, he said, you know, I knew I had to do this song because I knew it would make me feel closer to my father, who passed away at a young age before fulfilling his own dreams. So tragically, that happened with Jim too. You know, when he,
and the ironic thing is that when Jim Croce passed away, the song that was at the top of the charts was your song, I Got a Name.
It was, yeah. And by the way, then right after that, they pulled out another song of his called Time in a Bottle.
Right.
Which is an absolutely gorgeous song. And Jim had three albums of the top 10 at the same time. He became an iconic legend in just one moment, you know. And he's still revered as an artist, a songwriter, as a person. Lovely guy. Several years later, I got a call from his wife, Ingrid,
mm-hmm.
Who asked me if I would come, she lives in San Diego, if I would come down to San Diego and look through some of the songs that Jim left over, maybe I would finish some of those songs. And I said, Ingrid, I'd be honored to do that. And I said, you know, thank you for asking me. And she said, well, who else? You're the only other person whose song he sang. And, you know, a lot of people think that I Got a Name was written by Jim Croce, which I'm perfectly fine with, because, you know, he was a great songwriter, and fact that people think that that was one of his oeuvre, as they say, is fine with me. And but it's been great for me having, you know, that connection with Jim Croce, and it's a lot of people's favorite songs. So
Jim made it his own, which was, you know, the key to any kind of successful attempt at things like that.
You know, Lena Horne did that song in her act in Broadway years later, and she turned that song upside down and inside out, and did it her own way. And I heard that it was a song in her act. It wasn't an act. It was a Broadway show called Lena on Broadway. And when she did it at the in California at the Schubert Theater, I was able to go, and it was the second number in her show, right after she did a little of a signature song, Stormy Weather. And she jumped right into this song of mine, and Norma Gimbel's, and she was fantastic, and she brought such energy to it. She also brought reflections about her father into it that the audience got up and started cheering in the middle of the second number, myself included, you know. I didn't know that I would be so moved when I was watching the show, so I didn't make any plans to go backstage and see her, and I didn't know her at the time. But the next day, I sent her a bouquet of flowers, and I just said, from a grateful composer. And I got the nicest letter back, which I can pretty well quote because it's in a frame on my shelf all these years. And she wrote me back a letter. The next day, I got this letter to the composer of my favorite song. You have no idea what that song means to me. Every time I sing it, I think of my father and say thank you to him. So it's an interesting thing about songs, how people make connections with songs. It was the same with Jim Croce and her. I heard the same thing from Helen Reddy, how that song brought her closer to her own family.
It's interesting what songs do, and a lot of people have memories of Killing Me Softly and their thoughts on that, and Ready to Take a Chance Again. I mean, people take songs and they mean a lot to them. One of the things that I think is really interesting is TV theme songs, and you are one of the kings of TV theme songs, but people, when they hear the theme song to Happy Days or Laverne and Shirley or Love American Style or any of these songs, it brings them back to a different time.
You know, that's an opportunity that we had to do, you know, for myself in the 70s and the 80s into the 90s that they don't really do anymore, and it's too bad. I remember growing up in the 50s and hearing Davy Crockett, you know, I Love Lucy theme, and they brought you right into what the show is all about. And, of course, I had a very good fortune to do a lot of those themes in the 70s and the 80s, starting with Love American Style, and which led to Happy Days and Shirley and Angie, as you said, and Wonder Woman, and a lot of others, a lot of other songs. Cuts to the Chase, and too many to even remember it right now. But what they did was, my job was to capture the essence of the series, and so that when people heard the first minute of the show, they would remember how much they liked the show, would bring them right back into it. And by the time the show started each week, they were already brought into the character, into the tone of it. And of course, at the same time, I always used to try to write something that was catchy enough and unique enough to be able to have a record and hopefully have a hit record. And that happened a number of times with a number of different shows. They don't even have those opportunities anymore. You watch series now, they have 10 seconds, 15 seconds to establish a show, and usually while the credits are rolling from the previous show, it's kind of a mess, I think.
I kind of agree with you on that. It's interesting when you look at Happy Days. I remember when that first show first came out, and you know, the Fonz character was a very minor role. It didn't have the leather jacket. And Happy Days, actually, if I remember correctly, didn't play at the beginning. It was actually Rock Around the Clock that played.
You're absolutely right. Happy Days originally was just an episode or a segment of Love American Style. Love American Style had three separate stories every weekend, and ABC loved it because they could bury the price of a whole pilot as one of the episodes of Love American Style. Well, one day, we had an episode called Love and the Happy Days, and it was pretty much the same show as it done in the pilot, but ABC decided that the world wasn't ready to revisit the 50s yet. And not until George Lucas came out with American Graffiti, and that kind of opened up the door back to the 50s. So ABC put it on, but when they put the show on, it was a camera show. It was not a live tape show. It was a film show, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And the laugh track was all put on after because there was no live audience. The Fonz was not the star. He was a great character, but Ron Howard is clearly the lead actor. And they decided to go with the same Rock Around the Clock that American Graffiti is, just to try to follow.
Continuity's sake.
But we did write the song before, and our song was relegated to the end title only for the first year. In the second year, it was doing well, but not great. But ABC picked it up for second year. And lo and behold, things started to break open loose. The fans started getting lots of cards and letters, and he became, this great lovable figure in American television history. And at one point in the second year, they decided to revamp the format, do it as a four-camera live show with an audience. Gary Marshall created the show and produced it, used to come out and warm up the audience. And when they'd introduce the characters one by one, you had a sense of how important this was in history. And then they decided, well, at the same time, we might as well use the Happy Days song and go with that. Well, that Happy Days song became a record, became a number one record in countries around the world.
Pratt and McLean, I remember they saying that.
And the nice thing for me is that the Smithsonian called not so long ago and asked if I had a singular item that might go into the new American Music, Permanent Collection American Music Wing. And I said, well, I have this recording of Happy Days. It was the first and only record printed that if you would, when you see the opening title, there's a record that drops down onto the old-fashioned jukebox.
Mm-hmm.
And if you slow it down and stop it, you could see that record says Happy Days, music by Charles Fox, lyrics by Norman Gimbel. So that record is now going to be inducted, as they call it, into the Smithsonian. And it's going to sit next to the Fonz's jacket in the permanent exhibition in Washington.
That's exciting, huh?
Very tickled about that, yeah.
Wow.
And they said, I have a choice. I could either will it to them so they can have it after I'm gone, or I could give it to them now. I said, heck no, I want to see it. I'm going to wait until I'm gone.
That's really cool.
It's very cool, yeah.
And I remember, when Happy Days became a big hit and Laverne DeFazio and Shirley Feeney's characters were spun off, you had Cindy Grieco sing that. It was a great song that you composed for that one, and it became a huge hit, too.
We did. We were very lucky with that. That followed right on the heels of Happy Days. And, you know, the record business was so different those days. I called a friend of mine, Larry Utol, who owned his own company called Private Stock. It was a boutique record company. It made a lot of hits. And I said, Larry, Happy Days is on the charts. It's climbing up. He said, I know it. I said, I have another show right behind it called Laverne and Shirley. He said, I'm aware of it. I said, I think we could go right, have a 1-2 hit with this one final or the other. He said, go make it. Just tell me how much it costs. So in that one phone call, he gave me the go-ahead to make the record. He had a great promotional idea. He said, if I can get the two girls, Penny Marshall and Cindy...
Williams.
Cindy Williams, Penny Marshall. If I can get the two girls to do a quick promotional tour for a couple of hours, he said, I think I can break this record wide open in an instant. So one day I got Paramount and the producers to let me go with the girls. The record company sent a limo. And on their lunch break, me and Penny and Cindy went visiting record companies, the top 40 stations, and Billboard, Cashbox magazine. And by the time we finished, the record was being played all over the top 40 stations. By the end of the week, the record was a smash record.
And Making Our Dreams Come True was on the charts the same time as Happy Day song, wasn't it?
Right, so both of them were moving up the charts at the same time. Very exciting time for me to see that.
It's pretty cool. You've had so much incredible success that and it's going to continue. And it does with this book. It's called Killing Me Softly, My Life in Music. And it's available everywhere. But again, if you want to go directly, you can go to your website, which is killingmesoftly.com.
Right.
And
another second about something else very important in my life that's out right now. There's a film playing around the country called 100 Voices. That I happen to be in and part of. And the reason for that is a year ago, I was asked to write a piece based on the words of Pope John Paul II. These are words that he inserted in the Western Wall in Israel. He was the first pope to visit Israel. And I was on a trip, this was to be on a trip that I went on with 70 cantors going back to Poland, to the birthplace of cantorial music, which of course was wiped out as a result of the Holocaust. Well, I wrote this piece, and we had big concerts all over Poland, but this one was at the Warsaw Opera House, and I conducted the whole Warsaw Opera Company. We had 250 people on stage performing this oratorio of mine. That's all in the film. And then I found my father's town where he was born. He was born in Poland. And the filmmakers who were there on the trip asked if they could send a film crew with me to my father's town. Would hope they wouldn't be intrusive. And I thought it would be wonderful because then I could bring home pictures of the town of my, for my kids and my grandkids. Well, anyway, that whole travel back to my father's town, learning about it, became a part of this film. So I'm on the screen talking about my father's town and what happened to his family and all that, in addition to conducting. And anyway, this film is being shown at a lot of film festivals now. It's been playing around the country. So if anyone is interested, it's a film called 100 Voices, A Journey Home. And it's a very beautiful, touching film, not just about me, but the number of people whose lives have been touched by having family in Poland.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on. We have actually run out of time because there's so many questions I'd like to ask you, but maybe another time we'll get together.
Anytime at all, Mark. I'm delighted to talk to you.
Thanks again, Charles, and good luck with the new book.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Pleasure.